Hello, I'm Chubby Nebe. This is number 0348, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0348. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Alan Stanley, who is one of the three screenwriters who have banded together to put out a graphic novel entitled USNA 2 about the amalgamation of Canada and the United States.
The writing team is called the Real Wright Brothers, and we're screenwriters and have written probably 10 or 12 different screenplays. We have an animated feature that was produced and shown on HBO and the YTV network called The Adventures of Mowgli, which is the Jungle Book stories. Because of the difficulty that we had in selling our scripts and getting them produced, we thought that we would turn to graphic novels, because a lot of graphic novels today are being created into movies. So USNA was originally a screenplay.
Independent filmmaker Anthony D.P. Mann talks about the success he's had with his low-budget films shot entirely in Kingston, Ontario. It all started with a little Sherlock Holmes movie.
It opened a door to an American producer by the name of Bill Bossert getting in touch and saying, I liked Sherlock Holmes and the Shadow Watchers. I can't believe you did this for $24 and a case of beer, essentially. Is there a film you'd like to do? And I said, I've always wanted to do a proper adaptation of Stoker's Dracula. So he got behind it. We shot this thing for very, very little. And it was actually the first film ever shot in Kingston, Ontario, where I live and work, that was picked up by a Hollywood distributor.
David Michaels is the executive producer and senior vice president of the Daytime Emmy Awards. The awards will be handed out on May the 1st, but sadly, the show won't be televised this year.
It's certainly disappointing. It was totally a financial issue. But what we are going to do, I mean, number one, it's going to be like the biggest party of the year. So, you know, if you're in the room, there's no difference. And there's going to be a lot of opportunities for the fans to see what goes on, what went on. We have Entertainment Tonight and Access Hollywood and Extra. They are talking to people as they come off right after the win. We also do plan to air this probably the next day. So the fans will not see it happen live, but the fans will get to see it.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff. And of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0348 was Chubby Nebe, who is a marketing student at McGill University, who is also the host of a college radio show called Aloof Future on CJLO. And, as that's not enough, he's also one of a band of hotshot marketing students that is helping the Stuff File program find its financial footing in the cyber world. Thank you very much, Chubé, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A man pulled over in Niceville, Florida, on suspicion of drunk driving, admitted to the officer he had a sip of beer, but the reason she could smell it in his car was because he spilled it, he claimed. The officer found a half-empty can of beer, and the unnamed 20-year-old man agreed to be tested for drunkenness. "I'll do sobriety tests," he told her. "I'll do whatever the bleep you want. I cannot afford a ticket." Well, he failed the test, at one point claiming, "I seriously don't know the bleeping alphabet." The man knew his numbers, though. He could count to 25, though he had to pause to think between 12 and 13. He was arrested and charged with DUI. You know, maybe the judge can use that pausing just kind of revoke the guy's license for some time between 12 to 13 months. But seriously, is that really a test of someone's sobriety or their lack of education? Just asking. And 33-year-old Derek LaForest told police he went to a Taco Bell in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and when he learned it was closed, drove away, somehow hitting the building. The witnesses in the statements in the police report filled in the details. They say LaForest pulled up to the drive-through window shortly after 1:30 a.m. and began honking his horn. After he laid on the horn for at least 2 minutes, a staff member went outside to inform LaForest that they were closed. LaForest allegedly sped out of the drive-thru and through the parking lot until he hit a curb, lost control, hit a second curb, and smashed into a small structure that used to house an ATM. The impact caused extensive damage to the building, and LaForest was dragged unconscious from the car. He pleaded not guilty to charges of reckless driving and vandalism and was released on $500 bail. Well, he has completely redefined the term drive-through ATM, hasn't he? Yes. And speaking of smashing into things, a trained owl that was supposed to deliver the rings at a wedding in Ottawa instead took an ill-fated flight for freedom that ended up with a crash. A video from the wedding back in 2015, which is only now going viral, shows an owl named Max take off from its trainer's arm when it is summoned to perform its duties by a man saying, "Max, come here." Max appears initially to head towards the couple, but makes a turn and flies toward the back of the church. The owl seems to be making a break for freedom or at least some fresh air, but he ends up with neither when he crashes into the glass window and falls to the ground. The video's caption says the owl was hired to deliver the rings because the bride was a big fan of owls. According to the story, the owl is okay. I, on the other hand, wonder what kind of omen this says about that marriage. And by the way, if you'd like to see the ill-fated video, you can find it on the Stuff File fan page on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thestufffileprogram. It's a new fan page. If you like it, well, like it. Just click on the like button and you'll find this and other stories up there in video form as well. Okay, moving right along. A man stopped by a car dealership in Pompano Beach, Florida several times. He was interested in a particular used car listed at $32,900. It's a BMW X6, notes sales manager Evandro Pereira. It's a very high-end car. On one visit, 36-year-old Nicholas Jackson tried to buy it with his electronic benefits transfer card, commonly referred to as food stamps. Naturally, the dealership declined to accept the card. The next morning, employees arrived at the lot and noticed the car was missing. "I had an idea Jackson had taken it," Pereira said. "The first thing that came to my mind was him." Sure enough, the Martin County Sheriff's Office found Jackson in the car 75 miles away in Palm City. It was stalled out because he had run out of gas. Pereira was not particularly upset at the event. "What a hilarious thief," he said. Wow, glad he took it so well. Right, because, you know, if nothing else, obliviates are good for their entertainment value at the very least. Witness most of the people who appear on this show. At least in news story form anyway. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police in Franklin, Tennessee live tweeted the progress of an investigation in the town. A chicken on the loose downtown. The police department's tweet read, "It crossed the road and we're working to determine why." A few minutes later, residents could relax because police tweeted, "Situation secure, chicken is in custody." Yes, but they still never determined why it crossed the road. Perhaps more investigation is necessary, or, at the very least, just a rotisserie. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? There is a new graphic novel out by David Longsworth, Harry Kalensky, and Alan Stanley. It's called USNA 2, Book 1, The Match is Lit. Set in the future, it follows up on a previous graphic novel that tells the story of a time when Canada and the United States amalgamate. Alan Stanley joins us on the line right now from Vancouver. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. This idea of Canada and the United States amalgamating, some people think of it as an already foregone conclusion.
Well, I think in many ways our two countries are linked quite closely economically. And, you know, Pierre Elliott Trudeau said that when the it's like the elephant in a room, and when the elephant moves, you know, we're the ones who get pushed. We're certainly together, but in many ways, Canada is very, very different than the United States. You can just look at what the political situation is today with the race is going on for the presidential nominations and the kind of government that we just elected in our country.
Now, I mentioned you and your co-writers, and also there is an artist involved here too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Collectively, you are known as the Real Wright Brothers, is that right?
So the writing team is called the Real Wright Brothers, and we're screenwriters and have written probably 10 or 12 different screenplays and have been optioned. And we have an animated feature that was produced and shown on HBO and the YTV network called The Adventures of Mowgli, which is the Jungle Book stories. And because of the difficulty that we had in selling our scripts and getting them produced, we thought that we would turn to graphic novels, because a lot of graphic novels today are being created into movies, like the Batman series or Suicide Squad, which is coming up, is based on graphic novels. And so USNA was originally a screenplay.
And so is it the hope now that it is a graphic novel, that it will go back to its original roots and become a motion picture?
Yes, either that or a television series or something like that. But now that we've become publishers, we certainly really like the medium of graphic novels, because graphic novels in many ways are it's a movie in a book.
Were graphic novels something you were into before? I mean, you say you were a screenwriter, but as a fan, mm-hmm. were you into graphic novels before you actually embarked on writing one?
As a fan, I was. My two partners, Davey and Harry, grew up with comic books and are big fans of it, and can probably talk for hours about the various characters and the various artists over the years. And also our artists, Francine Delgado and our letterer, Chris Barrett, are both artists themselves full time and are well infused in it. So we really like the medium, really like graphic novels.
As I say, this is your second one, USNA 2, Book 1, The Match is Lit. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that there are some growing pains with the idea of the two countries joining together. Is that where the subtitle, The Match is Lit, comes from?
Yeah. Well, the first book, USNA, tells the story of the main characters who were part of the rebellion. So USNA is a time in the future when Canada and the U.S. are now a new country. But because of ongoing wars, food shortages, family farms disappearing and becoming prison farms, the people are unhappy. And so there's a rebellion that is beginning, led by a former prime minister named Samuel Stern. So the first book covers kind of the rebellion, how some of the rebels get together. They have a mountain stronghold near Calgary in the Rocky Mountains. And the second book, the rebellion starts to spread. So it goes to Chicago, to St. Louis, to San Francisco Harbor, Halifax. And that's why it's called The Match is Lit. And actually, we have the next book in the series will be out in 2 weeks. And the subtitle to that is The Flame Grows. So we're projecting that this just becomes a bigger event and more widespread, and more unhappiness and more kind of battles in different places throughout North America.
Besides the big battles that you bring up in this graphic novel, do you talk about some of the nuances of the two countries joining together? And the reason why I bring that up, I mean, as Canadians here, there are things we love about Canada and there are things that we love about the United States. But conversely, mm-hmm. there are things about the United States we're not necessarily crazy about, and I'm sure the reverse is said of Americans who think there are some things about Canada they're not really crazy about. How does that mesh together? For instance, something as contentious as gun laws.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way that we set it up politically is that all of the states and all of the provinces disappear, and there are five regions within North America that are now governing regions, and each region is controlled by a council made up of military and top business leaders and politicians. And there's a grand council out of the Pentagon rather than the White House that oversees everything. So all of the laws and everything are now being governed by these councils in different areas of the country. And And it's one of the things that the Canadians are unhappy about, is that they've kind of lost their autonomy and their identity as Canadians because they're now meshed with this whole thing. You know, we have a different sensibility, of course, than the Americans. And I think that, those are the kinds of things, the kinds of values that we write about in these books.
What's it like writing this with two other people? I mean, you're all coming together to collectively write this. What's that process like? Do you sit together? Do you do it via email, or do you Skype each other? What's the process like for you guys?
Yeah, well, actually, technology has helped us quite a bit, because we do use Skype quite a bit too. Davey Longworth is living in Langley outside of Vancouver, so it's a 45-minute drive, and it's a whole lot easier sometimes just to turn on Skype and talk face to face, and the same with Harry. What we do is that we find when there's three people, there's never any writing blocks, because there's always ideas coming. And we've written together for a long time, and we've learned to just take our egos and put them out the door, and so that if I come up with an idea and the other guys go, well, this doesn't work because this character wouldn't do that, or it doesn't work with the plot, I don't take it personally. Our intent is to make the best possible work that we can, and so we work together in order to do that. And it's really a lot of fun, because we're friends first before we're artists, and so we always enjoy getting together and working together. And of course, everyone has a different personality, and so there's always times when maybe you might not agree with things, but it's fun to work with other people.
Now, we should mention USNA stands for the United States of North America. I didn't mention that at the beginning, in case somebody's wondering what USNA stands for. As I mentioned, the second book is out, USNA 2, Book 1, The Match is Lit. You already say the third one is on its way, too. How far ahead are you guys?
In terms of the development of the story?
Yes.
We originally, as I said, wrote it as a screenplay, and we never imagined that we would be continuing the story. And when we published USNA, it's a graphic novel of about 215 pages. And we were selling it mostly through fan expos in Calgary and in Vancouver and Toronto. And the reception was so good that people said, well, okay, this is great, but what happens next? So we had to kind of reset and go, okay, well, what does happen next? Because it takes an artist so long to do the art, because every page in a graphic novel is usually, on average, 6 panels of original art. It took our artist, Dave Casey, for the first book, over 3 years just to draw the book. And because there was demand for more story, we decided that we would make the book smaller. And then once we've got 3 books, we'll combine them into one big one. So USNA 2, Book 1, is about 60 pages, and it'll be the same for USNA 2, Book 2. But this way we can get a book out every year and keep our fans happy. So we've already started writing the next one, and we'll see after that whether we continue or not. Again, it will depend on the demand of the fans.
Do you know when you're writing, and again, you write this collectively, do you know when you're writing where you're going? Do you have a Bible as to how this all ends, and you fill in the gaps in between to flesh out the story? Or do you learn about the story and the characters as you write?
I think it's more the latter, that we learn more about the story as we write. We have had on occasion events that we wanted to include in it. For example, in book one, all of the rebels are in this tower in Calgary where it was a former, there's a group in USNA called SHADOW, the Strategic Home Alliance Defense Organization, and they are the anti-rebel group. So the rebels have taken over a tower that was a SHADOW tower, and now they've barricaded themselves in it. And what, unbeknownst to them, and something that they do find out, is that they, the SHADOW, have set up explosives in the building so that it will implode, similar to what happened in New York in 9/11, where the buildings collapsed. And so we had this kind of image of a building collapsing in Calgary, and so we wanted to include that in the book. So there are things like that come up that we decide we're going to incorporate in the book, and then we work the story around that. But usually what happens when you're writing is the characters kind of reveal themselves, and the stories reveal themselves, and new ideas kind of appear. You know, creative people always talk about how they have to sort of get out of the way and just allow the process to happen. And it's very much the same with the writing of these stories.
Have you had an opportunity to talk to any politicians or political science professors about the very idea of USNA?
Yeah, actually, there was a professor in a small college in Calgary, whose name eludes me at the moment, Mount Royal College, who invited us to speak to their class. And they had a class that was revolving around the relationship of the Canada and the U.S. around the border. And so we went into Calgary and spoke to this class for, I think, an hour, hour and a half about the politics of USNA and our graphic novel and publishing and all that. And it was great to speak to a group of younger people who are really quite interested and quite keen on this whole political idea of Canada and the U.S. and the possibility of an amalgamation.
How does one get their hands on USNA?
Well, one of the things that has happened recently for us is that our distributor has gotten our books into Chapter stores. So you can go into any Chapter or Indigo store across Canada, and if they don't have it in the store, then you can go to their kiosk and order it, and you'll get it within a week or two from Chapters. And you can go to our site, and we've listed all of the stores that are carrying it at the moment. And if you're a bookstore, you can go to our site, and the link to the distributor is there, so you can have the book ordered to your store through our distributor.
And that site is usna.ca. Alan, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Alan Stanley, one of the writers behind USNA 2, Book 1, The Match is Lit. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0348, and you'll find links to their website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the graphic novel directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Experiencing the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk with independent filmmaker Anthony D.P. Mann. Plus, we'll have a chat with the executive producer and senior vice president of the Daytime Emmy Awards about the upcoming gala that will take place at the beginning of May. And there is, of course, an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news right here, right now. On a program I also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Now, in the latest episode of An Over-the-Top Excessive Cat, Sarah Nathan's Bridget, age 6, had her cover blown in March when she collected a dozen boxer briefs and about 60 socks, all apparently klepto-lifted from neighbors in Hamilton, New Zealand. Nathan admitted that she may ultimately have to stash some underwear around her farm just to keep Bridget stimulated. Well, I know some people who that plan has worked for, so why not a cat? And police in Georgia have arrested a man for allegedly causing a stink at a bar. The Athens Banner-Herald reports a woman told officers that 20-year-old Blake Leland Zengo of Bogart sprayed her in the face with a product designed to smell like flatulence. An Athens Clark County police report says several people left the bar Saturday, citing a foul smell inside, and then told police that Zengo was the culprit. The police report described Zengo as very inebriated and said a bottle of spray designed to cause an offensive odor was found in his pants pocket. Zengo denied spraying anything. He was arrested and charged with disorderly conduct, public intoxication, and underage consumption of alcohol. He was released from jail on $1,500 bond. You know, this brings new meaning to the term stinking drunk, doesn't it? Yeah. And by the way, I must lead a sheltered life because I didn't even know you could buy something called fart spray. But I checked Amazon.com and you can order it for about $6 a can. Oh, and there's a slightly more expensive version available called Liquid Ass. And it has a very interesting story behind it. I think maybe we'll try to track down the manufacturer for a future show. So stay tuned as I hunt down Liquid Ass. And Department of Veterans Affairs employee, 39-year-old Elizabeth Rivera Rivera, or Elizabeth Rivera Squared, I guess you could call her, was fired after her arrest followed by a February guilty plea for armed robbery. But when she was sentenced only to probation, an arbitrator ordered the VA to rehire her and give her back pay that she earned while sitting in jail awaiting trial. She had been the driver for a man arrested for a street robbery in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Rivera's union had demanded the reinstatement without salary penalty for fairness because the same Puerto Rico VA office had earlier hired a convicted sex offender and the office's hospital director recently charged with DUI and drug possession avoided VA discipline because of technicalities about the traffic stop. Wow, nothing like the power of precedent, huh? What a fine collection of employees at the Puerto Rico VA. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, in February, a family court in England reduced the child support payments from hedge fund financier Christopher Rokas to the mother of his 7-year-old son from the equivalent of about $17,000 a month to about $11,300 per month, though that amount includes more than $1,200 a month for wine. And I'm talking about the drinkable kind, not W-H-I-N-E. Wine. $1,200 a month in wine in a child support settlement? Either that kid is on his way to being a lush, or he's a complete handful. One or the other. And by the way, if you're spending $1,200 a month in wine, isn't that the very definition of alcoholism? Just asking. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff All program, shall we? Anthony D.P. Mann is an independent filmmaker who has carved out a niche in the world of genre tales of horror and suspense. He's played and directed such roles as Sherlock Holmes, Dracula, the works of Dickens, and even original works that are true to the genre, and he has succeeded in the world of direct-to-video sales. He has also branched out into audio recordings, with his latest release being Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. Anthony joins us on the line right now via Skype from Kingston, Ontario, to talk about his macabre work. Hi, Anthony.
Hello, Peter. You know, Peter, I feel I should begin this by saying, hey there, hi there, ho there, which was the opening of the Peter Anthony Holder Show, a landmark during my own childhood and teenage years in Montreal. And I'm so happy to be connected with you again, because a lot of this happened because you gave us a chance. You gave us a break on radio back in the heyday of good Montreal radio.
And hey there, hi there, ho there is still the opening of this show, too. So it continues years later.
Ah, excellent.
So, as you just mentioned, yeah, you were on the old radio show. You would do live radio drama for us in the overnight hours on occasions. And you've really taken this into a whole new direction with, admittedly, a genre that many had thought had gone by the wayside. You have resurrected it in your own little way and have done very well with it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've always had an old soul and an interest in the classics. And years ago, you know, Peter, that first show that we did Phantom of the Opera on Halloween night 1996 with you. I remember this. And I was 18 years old at the time. And you gave us a chance. We came on and we did that. And really, I haven't stopped doing that. It's just kind of changed mediums along the way. And for some crazy, audacious, absurd reason, people actually seem to be enjoying and willing to put some money behind what we're doing. In 2010, I decided to pick up a camera and make a Sherlock Holmes film because I had the opportunity to play Holmes on radio back in the day. And the Conan Doyle Estate actually gave us authorization to do an original piece. We did it. It was called Sherlock Holmes and the Shadow Watchers. It's out there in the ether. It actually got picked up by my distributor, Reality Entertainment, a year and a half ago, and it's done. It's actually, of all my films, it's the best performing. It's the most top selling film that we have. I know this because there's more bad reviews of this film than any other film that I've done. But that's always a good thing. But what that did was it opened a door to an American producer by the name of Bill Bossert getting in touch and saying, I like Sherlock Holmes and the Shadow Watchers. I can't believe you did this for $24 in a case of beer, essentially. Is there a film you'd like to do? And I said, I've always wanted to do a proper adaptation of Stoker's Dracula. So he got behind it. We shot this thing for very, very little. And it was actually the first film ever shot in Kingston, Ontario, where I live and work, that was picked up by a Hollywood distributor. In fact, that film hit the market everywhere, and I've shown it in Cardiff, Wales. I've been to Montreal Comic Con, Fan Expo. It's on DVD shelves at Walmart and Best Buy, and that led to other films as well, like a film called Ghost Keepers, in which I play a washed-up horror film actor. I don't know if that's a precursor. We moved on to Phantom of the Opera because I look great behind a mask, and just recently, in an absolute change of genre, we just completed and released quite successfully a brand new Canadian set musical film version of Dickens' A Christmas Carol, in which I play Scrooge, and we have one of my heroes now, one of the original Doctor Who is Colin Baker as Charles Dickens. So, yeah, it's been a crazy ride, but, you know, I'm not entirely certain much has changed in 20 years.
As you alluded to, and as I said in the introduction, you are in Kingston, Ontario, which is not exactly known for being the hotbed of entertainment or filmmaking. How did you end up in Kingston? And for those listening and who aren't aware, Kingston is somewhere halfway between Montreal and Toronto. It's not a large community. Up until recently, it was known for basically the home of prisons and a great university, which is an interesting interesting grouping of people when you think about it. So how did you end up in Kingston?
You know, it was kind of on a whim. I moved here. I moved here on account of romance many moons ago. Well, romance took off after 3 months, but it left me behind. And I decided, you know, this is a really interesting place. There's a lot of old architecture here. There's kind of a vibe that I like. I started to meet some wonderful, talented individuals, and then weaseled my way behind the scenes, and then in front of the lenses with the local television station, and really learned the craft of being a broadcaster, being a presenter, and then also, you know, understanding the mechanics of producing television, producing film. And my career is an absolute my career is an absolute sham, actually, because the only thing that I'm trained in is music, voice, and piano. Everything else I've learned in the field. You know, I always say that I attended the film school of film, in that I'm like yourself, I'm an absolute movie buff, a movie lover. And by studying the films that I love, I think I've been able to discern what works for me and what works for an audience. And and somehow now I've become recognized not only as a ham, but as a filmmaker.
So growing up and having this appreciation for the classics that you do, did that make you sort of odd man out or odd kid out growing up amongst your friends and peers? Are you also a fan of more contemporary film work, or are you solely geared toward the classics and the films that a generation before you literally grew up with?
Well, you know, I've always gravitated towards older films, but I mean, I enjoy modern films as well. In fact, I'm so much more forgiving, than most of my friends. But you know, I did grow up on the Universals, the Hammer films, the old BBC productions. I remember you used to chide me 20 years ago about my musical interest in Roger Whittaker. That's never ceased. I flew over to Germany to see him a couple of years ago. So, you know, I've always kind of existed in a different era. But what that has done, it's allowed me the joy of being able to introduce friends and contemporaries to, you know, to traditions and to actors and to films that they would have otherwise never experienced before. So, you know what, I've never felt ostracized or anything along those lines. I've always had the opportunity to entertain and enrich and educate, kind of like you do right here on this program.
Well, you know, I said it 20 years ago. I'll say it again. There's got to be a 12-step program for your Roger Whittaker fixation.
Oh, if there is, you could have saved me thousands of dollars.
So with all that you're doing, and as I said, you've branched out in direct-to-video sales. You're doing these albums. Is there something still that you're craving to do that is still eluding you that you really want to do?
You know, Christmas Carol was really kind of completing my bucket list, and I can't believe I got to it this soon. So, you know, now, believe it or not, a couple of interesting things. You mentioned that we've just released a single of The Raven through Fangoria Music. When I say we, it's Maurizio Guarini, who's a member of the iconic Italian progressive rock band Goblin, who scored a lot of Dario Argento's old films and the original Dawn of the Dead. We just released this Poe thing, and it's gone out through Fangoria's music label, and from what I understand, the single's doing well. I'm actually now looking back at my first love, which was radio theater, and actually, it just so happens that today I put a couple of offers out to some very interesting actors whose names I can't mention yet in regards to producing some audio adaptations, again, of the classics like Dracula, like Frankenstein, like The Phantom of the Opera, and releasing those digitally online. So if all goes well, you know, I think I'm kind of reviewing I'm reviewing the things that I've done so far and the things that I enjoy doing, and I'm looking backwards now and kind of celebrating those things that brought me so much enjoyment years ago. So that's where the future lies, I think, is doing some audio productions for a while, and then at the end of this year, we're probably going to gear up with a continuation of our Christmas Carol, and that's called A Carol for Peace, and it follows Tiny Tim through World War I and the Christmas Truce of 1914. So lots of exciting things, a little bit of wholesome stuff, some of the creepy stuff, and you know, just so happy to be chatting with somebody who was a mentor to me back when I was first deciding what I wanted to do with my life, Peter. And you really had a lasting effect, and I'm so happy that you're continuing to do this in this new medium, and I can't wait till we can chat again.
Well, speaking of new medium, when we first chatted again some 20 odd years ago, there wasn't the internet the way it is now, and there wasn't streaming and all that's available in online. Has that helped you a lot in the things that you're doing? Has that advanced your career in a way you hadn't seen it advancing or thought of it advancing when you began?
Oh, absolutely. In incredible ways. I mean, we never would have been able to get our films out as we had. Like Dracula, for instance, that was an amazing story. We had printed up 1,500 DVDs we were going to sell at conventions or what have you, and actually had to pull them all because within a matter of 2 weeks after we finished this thing, we had sent an online screener to a company to a major distributor online. And they grabbed it. They grabbed the film and put out their own version. I was able to share my work with Fangoria magazine, who did a 3-page feature on Terror of Dracula. Like when I was a kid, you know, all my friends wanted to be on the cover of Sports Illustrated or you know, Teen Scream. I wanted to be in Fangoria, so that happened. You know, we've been exhibited. Like I said, I was in Cardiff, Wales a couple of years ago showing Terror of Dracula. We put together the budget for A Christmas Carol, reaching out to people online, not necessarily by Kickstarter, but using social media to gain interest. We got Colin Baker involved, initially just doing voiceover, across the internet, and then we're able to catch up with him when he was at a convention in Canada to actually film with him. So the idea now of going back and, you know, really exploring the possibilities that the internet has to offer, like Vimeo on demand or Amazon Prime, which is really a way that people are making a lot of money. Now the idea of doing some digital downloads of audio plays the way I want to hear them, I think is a way of celebrating, kind of tying the past, this classic form of presentation, with the modern era. You know, the being able to see something online. I used to spend weekends scouring video stores trying to find rare movies that I wanted to see. Now with a click of my mouse, I can watch them almost instantly on Apple TV or on YouTube. And I think the possibilities are endless. That also means that the competition is fierce. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more competition out there, right? Because anybody can make a movie on their cell phone. So the question is how to do it well and how to get it seen by the right people. So it's a challenge, but there's so many possibilities.
Well, congratulations on your success. People can find out more information by going to your website, Anthony D.P. Mann, with two N's, anthonydpmann.com. Anthony, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Oh, Peter, thank you very much. I'm so happy that you're out there and you're still doing this program. It was, again, such a delight to me growing up listening to your show. And when anybody asks who your influences were, you're always in that top three, right below Roger Whittaker.
Thanks, sir.
Cheers.
Independent filmmaker Anthony D.P. Mann. You can go to my website at thestuffall.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0348, and you'll find links to Anthony's website. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Imagine this situation. You're the volunteer coach for your son or daughter's Little League baseball team, and it's time to fill out the roster. Your center fielder has the flu, so you put another player there. A batter hits a pop fly to center, but the fielder misses it and gets hit in the eye. What do you do? Well, how about call a defense lawyer? Several years ago, the president of Little League Baseball told Congress that story to reveal how bad America's lawsuit problem has become. In that case, the player's parents sued for medical costs, pain and suffering, and punitive damages, all because of a mishandled pop fly. Let's be fair. Sometimes it seems that America's new national pastime is filing lawsuits. A new lawsuit is filed every 2 seconds in America. And unless the courts solve this problem, it may get to the point where the only people qualified to coach Little League Baseball anymore are moms and dads with a law degree. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the upcoming Daytime Emmy Awards. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day, but I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. In March, Kingdom Hall in the South London district of Camberwell was fined the equivalent of about $10,900 by the Southwark Council for its amplified music and incessant loud preaching, ritually performed almost daily at around 3 a.m. A spokesperson told the London Evening Standard that the timing was necessary because that is when evil spirits are most likely to be present. Well, having had a career which required me to be a night owl, there is something to be said for the devil making his rounds before dawn, but hey, it's not like Satan is sleeping at noon. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? The 43rd Daytime Emmy Awards will be handed out on Sunday, May 1st in Los Angeles. Unfortunately, it will not be broadcast. But as the saying goes, the show must go on. So here to talk about the Daytime Emmy Awards is David Michaels, the executive producer and senior vice president for the Daytime Emmy Awards. He joins us on the line from New York. Hi, David.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So right off the bat, let's bring up this whole thing about it not being televised. That must be problematic for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly disappointing. It was totally a financial issue. But what we are going to do, I mean, number one, it's going to be like the biggest party of the year. So, you know, if you're in the room, there's no difference. And there's going to be a lot of opportunities for the fans to see what goes on, what went on. In that we have, you know, the three major, we have Entertainment Tonight and Access Hollywood and Extra. They're talking to people as they come off right after the win. And there'll be some people there from Periscope. And we also do plan to air this probably the next day. And it's just the actual place we're airing it is still TBD because we're talking to a few people. But so the fans will not see it happen live, but the fans will get to see it,
and it's
which
not,
I think is important.
And it's not available even via streaming?
No, we're not going to stream live that night. But like I said, there's going to be all kinds of live activity going on that night, as well as social media. And then I would hope by the next day the fans will actually get to see exactly what happened.
You know, I've got a theory about awards shows and the problems that award shows are having. And I'm not just talking about the Emmys. I'm talking about the evening Emmys and also the Oscars. You know, I watch award shows because I am a fan of whatever medium that particular award show is honoring. I'm not necessarily looking for a spectacular entertainment event taking place on the night that it's shown. I just want to know who won, and I want to honor those who won and hear what they have to say and share in their joy and excitement. Do you think that sometimes networks have gotten the wrong idea about what an award show is supposed to be?
Well, I think you're right. I think, you know, they've kind of gotten away. I mean, because it is about the awards. And, you know, some of the shows really aren't. Like, you know, the Grammy Awards, let's be real. It's about entertainment. It's about performances. You know, that's a whole different thing. The problem I see, I mean, I'm a big fan of award shows. But if you look at the ratings of every single award show this year, they're all down. So we're in some kind of a period where that's unfortunately what's happening, and that certainly makes it harder to get sponsors excited and stuff like that. It's, and believe me, I'm not saying no one's watching, but absolutely every major award show has gone down in the last year in their ratings.
So as the
I can't tell you why, but right. It's kind of upsetting to me.
So as the executive producer of the 43rd Daytime Emmy Awards, how does your job change with the show not being televised? What do you have to do differently, and how do you produce a program like that? Or is it the same as if it were televised?
Well, the big difference is that we're not this year working with an outside production company, so it's all kind of fallen on my head. I mean, that's the biggest difference that I see. But as far as the actual production of the show, I'm going to produce it as if we're doing a live broadcast. Like I said, I don't want people in the room to perceive any difference at all. And yeah, and we're going to treat it like a live broadcast. We're going to time it like a live broadcast. So the only thing missing is the live broadcast.
Daytime television, well, the television in general has changed dramatically over the last few years. I mean, let's just look at daytime TV. When you guys first started 43 years ago, we were talking about basically three television networks and PBS. Now it's a whole range of things. You have shows that are nominated for, that are on YouTube, shows that are nominated that are streamed. Does that blur the lines of what is indeed daytime television?
No, I think it enhances it, actually. I mean, if there's anything negative about that, it's that sometimes you can't really determine a time of something, because you know, there's kind of no time on the internet. But we look at the genre of the show. So if something's a soap opera, it's going to go to us. If it's children's programming, young children's programming, it's going to go to us. If it's you know, if it's a daytime talk show that just happens to be online, it goes to us. An example of that is Larry King has a show that's only online, and he's been nominated. But the lines are blurring, most definitely.
with those blurring lines and with more platforms available for which one can watch television nowadays, people always talk about the so-called golden age of television. Are we, for lack of a better term, in a renaissance period now with the explosion of potential that's out there because of the various platforms and the integrity and diversity of the people who are putting together these shows?
I think it is, in a way, a new renaissance because there are just so many, not only different platforms, but I think different kinds of shows, because on some of the newer platforms, there are less restrictions on what you can do. So I think it's opening it up. And I think, the younger viewers who, to me, I want to sit in my living room and watch my big screen TV, and then I'm happy. And it's usually something that I've DVR'd. But, a lot of the younger generation don't want to watch TV. They want it on their phone. They want it on their tablet. And it's just kind of a whole different world. Young people go and get their first apartment. They don't even have a TV. They watch everything on their phone or their computer or their tablet. And it's just the way the world is changing. And it's not the way I want to watch stuff, but if that's how they want to watch it, as long as they're watching, it's fine with me, you know?
Well, let's talk about the 43rd Annual Daytime Emmy Award ceremony that's going to be taking place on Sunday, May the 1st. What are some of the things you can share with us? Obviously, you don't know the winners, obviously, but what can you share with us as far as some of the events are going to be taking place, some of the people who are going to be honored?
Well, I'll just start with, we're going to have our red carpet that's as big as the one we had last year at Warner Brothers, with all kinds of live coverage. A great cocktail party follows that. And then when they came into the show, some elements that we're excited about, certainly giving the Lifetime Achievement Award to Sonia Manzano, who has, been the beloved Maria on Sesame Street for over 40 years, and she has just retired from that. That's going to be a beautiful presentation. We still have some surprise video elements coming in, that I'll let be a surprise. I'm approaching it just like the broadcast show. We have great presenters lined up, which we'll be announcing, I would say, next week. We have a live band. It's going to be quite a party. The people sitting in the room get champagne and munchies during the show because they have to wait till the show's over for their dinner. So it's a definite party atmosphere. Hopefully not as much partying as at the Golden Globes, but that's the atmosphere.
As the executive producer of this event, which again, like I say, is not being televised, do you have to... Does the fact that it's not being televised remove the idea of you having to be literally a slave to the clock?
No. I mean, like I said, we have it timed out like a live show, and we'd like to keep it to the 2 hours, but nothing's going to happen to us if we don't. I mean, is that what you're asking?
Yes, exactly.
But, we think 2 hours is a nice length for this show. We think people are hungry by the time those 2 hours are over. And the plan is to go in there and do a two-hour show.
People can find out more information by going to the website. The website is?
Most of our information, even more than on the website, is on our Daytime Emmys Facebook page. You can find out almost anything there, but you can go to the website, which is emmyonline.tv, and there's information about all the things we do.
Well, as the saying goes, good luck, break a leg, have a great time on the 1st of May. I'm sorry that I can't watch it live, but as you say, it will be available in the days to follow, and I definitely will watch for that. And thanks very much for being on the program with us.
Oh, well, thanks. Please call anytime.
David Michaels, the executive producer and senior vice president of the Daytime Emmy Awards. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0348, and you'll find links to their website, which features all the information on the Daytime Emmys, including a complete list of the nominees. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot. of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff file presents the idiot of the day.
It's bad enough that 26-year-old Alfonso Mobley Jr. is a sovereign citizen, self-proclaimed as exempt from obeying laws or paying taxes. But on April the 5th, he also lost both hands when a bomb he was working on exploded in Columbus, Ohio. And by the way, when you're arresting someone who has blown off their hands, how do you handcuff them? Anyway, the bomb was made from the same material as that in the November terrorist attacks in Paris. A 2010 FBI report labeled sovereign citizens a domestic terrorist group, but Mobley's associate, who was not hurt, told police the bomb was to be simply a diversion for their planned bank or armored car robbery. So, I guess that makes it all better. There is no word yet on where Mobley learned to make the compound, although perhaps the word learned is too strong use here. I mean, why would you be handling such explosive material if you really didn't know what you were doing? And why would anyone want to be considered a sovereign citizen anyway? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0348. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links to all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0348. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR in Nashville, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.